Additional nobleman, the Baron had installed dungeons, interrogation rooms, and a well-equipped torture chamber. He also had a party room on that level, where he often took young boys from the fishing village. "You can't remove the marks of House Atreides with such cosmetic changes, Grandfather," said the pestering voice of Aaliyah. "I preferred the old castle." "Shut up, devil child. You were never here in life either." "Oh, I visited my ancestral home when my mother lived here, when Mordib was emperor and his jihad splashed blood across the star systems. Don't you remember, Grandfather? Or weren't you inside my head then?"
"I wish you weren't inside mine. I was born before you. I can't possibly have your memories inside me. You're an abomination."
Aaliyah chuckled in a particularly disconcerting way.
"Yes, Grandfather, I'm that, and much more. Perhaps that's why I have the power to be inside you. Or perhaps you are just flawed, completely mad. Have you considered the possibility that you might be imagining me? That's what everyone else thinks."
Servants hurried by, glancing fearfully at him. Just then the Baron saw a ground car negotiating the steep road from the spaceport.
"Ah, here is our guest."
Despite Aaliyah's intrusion, he expected this to be an entertaining day. After the ground car pulled up, a tall man stepped out of the rear compartment and made his way past statues of great Harkonnens that the Baron had erected in the past year. A suspensor platform floated behind the antiquities dealer, carrying his wares.
"What do you plan to do with him, Grandfather?"
"You know damned well what I'm going to do."
High on the wall above, the Baron rubbed his hands together in gleeful anticipation.
"Make yourself useful for a change, abomination."
Aaliyah giggled, but it sounded as if she was laughing at him. The Baron hurried down as a haunted-looking house servant escorted the visitor inside. Shay Vendee was an antiquities dealer, always pleased to meet with one of his best customers. As he strolled in with his goods trailing behind him, his round face shone as radiantly as a small red sun. The Baron greeted him with a moist handshake, clasping with both hands and holding on a little too long, squeezing a bit too hard. The merchant extricated himself from his customer's grip.
"You'll marvel at what I've brought, Baron. Amazing what turns up with a little digging."
He opened one of the cases on the suspensor platform.
"I saved these treasures especially for you."
The Baron brushed a speck off one of the jeweled rings on his fingers.
"First, I have something to show you, my dear Mr. Vendee. My new wine cellar. I am quite proud of it."
A look of surprise.
"Are the Danian vineyards operating again?"
"I have other sources."
After the dealer disengaged his suspensor platform, the Baron led him down a wide rock staircase into increasing gloom. Oblivious to the danger, Vendee chattered cordially.
"Caladan wines used to be quite famous, and deservedly so. In fact, I heard a rumor that a cache was found on the ruins of Catane. Bottles perfectly preserved in a null entropy vault. The null entropy field prevented the wine from aging and mellowing, in this case for thousands of years. But even so, the vintage must be quite extraordinary. Would you like me to see if I can acquire a bottle or two for you?"
The Baron stopped at the bottom of the dim stairs and peered with spider-black eyes at his guest.
"So long as you can provide the appropriate documentation. I wouldn't want to be duped into buying anything fake."
Vendi wore a look of horror.
Of course not, Baron Harkonnen.
Finally, they passed through a narrow corridor illuminated by smoking oil lamps. Glow globes were too efficient and harsh for the Baron's taste. He loved the dank, gritty smell of the air. It almost masked the other odors.
Here we are.
The Baron pushed open a heavy wooden door and led the way into his fully stocked torture chamber. It had the traditional accoutrement, racks, masks, electrified chairs, and a strapado by which a subject could be alternately hoisted into the air and dropped.
This is one of my new playrooms. My pride and joy.
Vendee's eyes opened wide in alarm.
I thought you said we were going to your wine cellar.
Why, over there, my good man.
With a good-natured expression, the Baron pointed to a table from which loose straps hung. A wine bottle and two glasses sat on top. He poured red wine into both glasses and handed one to his increasingly agitated guest. Vendi glanced around, nervously eyeing the red stains on the table and rock floor.
Spilled wine?
I have just made a long journey, and I'm tired. Maybe we should go back up to the main rooms.
You will be absolutely delighted with the new items I've brought. Quite valuable relics, I assure you. The Baron fingered one of the straps on the table.
There is another matter first.
He narrowed his eyes. From a side door, a sunken-eyed boy marched in, carrying what looked like two ornate old weapons, disc handguns of ancient manufacture.
Do these look familiar? Examine them carefully.
Vendi held one weapon to examine it.
Oh, yes. The antique gun of Aaliyah Atreides, used by her own hands.
So you said.
Taking the other handgun from the serving boy, the Baron said to Vendi,
you sold me a fake. I happen to know that the gun you hold is not the original weapon used by Aaliyah.
I have a reputation for integrity, Baron.
If anyone has told you otherwise, they are lying.
Unfortunately for you, my source is beyond reproach.
You are lucky to have me inside you to point out your mistakes,
Aaliyah said,
if you believe I am real.
Indignantly, Vendi placed the gun on the table and turned to leave. He only made it halfway to the door. The Baron pulled the trigger of his own weapon, and a large spinning disc shot out and hit the dealer squarely in the back of his neck, decapitating him. Swiftly, smoothly, the Baron was sure it hadn't hurt a bit.
Good shot, eh?
The Baron grinned at the serving boy. The servant did not flinch at the murder.
Will that be all you desire from me, sir?
You don't expect me to clean up this mess myself, do you?
No, my lord. I will get right to it.
Then wash yourself afterward.
The Baron looked him over.
We'll have even more fun this afternoon.
Meanwhile, he went back upstairs to study what the antique dealer had brought with him.
Once, I was born of a natural mother, and then reborn many times as a Gola.
Considering the millennia over which the Bene Gesserit, the Tleilaxu, and others have meddled with the gene pool, I wonder, are any of us truly natural anymore? Ship's Log, Entry of Duncan, Idaho. Today, Gurney Halleck would be born again. Paul Atreides had looked forward to this during the months-long gestation process. Since the recent birth of his sister Aaliyah, the waiting had become nearly unbearable. But in a matter of hours, Gurney would be removed from the axolotl tank. The famed Gurney Halleck. In his studies under Proctor Superior Garimi, Paul had read much about the troubadour warrior, had seen images of the man and heard recordings of his songs. But he wanted to know the real Gurney, his friend, mentor, and protector from an epic time. Someday, though their ages were topsy-turvy now, the two would remember how close their friendship had been. Paul couldn't keep the grin off his face as he rushed to get ready. Whistling an old Atreides song that he'd learned from Gurney's recorded collection, he stepped into the corridor and Chaney emerged from her own quarters to join him. 2 years his junior, the 13-year-old was whip-thin and fast, soft-spoken and beautiful, only a preview of the woman she would become again. Knowing their destinies, she and Paul were already inseparable. He took her hand, and the pair happily hurried toward the medical center. He wondered if Gurney would be an ugly baby, or if he had only become a rolling lump of a man after being battered by the Harkonnens. He hoped the Gurney Gola would have a natural skill with the Baliset, too. Paul was confident that the no-ship's stores could recreate one of the antique musical instruments. Maybe the two of them could play music together. Others would be there for the new birth. His mother, Jessica, Thufir Hawat, and almost certainly Duncan Idaho. Gurney had many friends aboard. No one on the ship had known Xavier Harkonnen or Serena Butler, the other two Golas who would be decanted today, but they were legends from the Butlerian Jihad. Each Gola, according to Shiana, had a role to play, and any one of them, or all of them together, might be the key to defeating the enemy. Aside from the Gola children, many other boys and girls had been born over the years of the Ithaca's long flight. The sisters bred with male Bene Gesserit workers who had also escaped from Chapter House. They understood the need to increase their population and prepare a solid foundation for a new colony if the no-ship ever found a suitable planet to settle. The rabbi's group of Jewish refugees, who had also married and begun families, still waited for a new home to fulfill their long quest. The no-ship was so vast, and the population aboard still so far below its capacity, that there was no real concern about running short on resources. Not yet. As Paul and Chaney approached the main birthing creche, four female proctors ran toward them down the hall, urgently calling for any qualified Sook doctor.
"They're dead. All three of them."
Paul's heart stuttered. At 15, he was already training in some of the skills that had once made him the historic leader known as Muad'Dib. Summoning all the steel he could put into his voice, he demanded that the second proctor stop.
"Explain yourself,"
the Bene Gesserit blurted, surprised into her answer.
"Three axolotl tanks, three Golas, sabotage, and murder. Someone destroyed them."
Paul and Chaney rushed toward the medical center. Duncan and Shiana were already in the doorway looking shaken. Inside the chamber, three axolotl tanks had been ripped from their life support mechanisms and lay in puddles of burned flesh and spilled liquid. Someone had used an incinerating beam and corrosives to destroy not only the life support machinery, but the core flesh of the tanks and the unborn Golas. Gurney Halleck, Xavier Harkonnen, Serena Butler, all lost. And the tanks, which had once been living women. Duncan looked at Paul, articulating the real horror here. "We have a saboteur aboard. Someone who wishes to harm the Gola Project. Or maybe all of us."
"But why now?" Paul asked.
The ship has been fleeing for 2 decades, and the Gola project began years ago. What changed?
Maybe someone was afraid of Gurney, Shiana suggested. Or Xavier Harkonnen, or Serena Butler.
Paul saw that the other 3 axolotl tanks in the creche had not been harmed, including the one that had recently given birth to the spice-saturated Aaliyah. Standing by Gurney's tank, he saw the dead, half-born baby among the burned and dissolved folds of flesh. Nauseated, he knelt to touch the few wisps of blonde hair.
Poor Gurney.
As Duncan helped Paul to his feet, Shiana said in a coldly businesslike voice, "We still have the cellular material. We can grow replacements for all of them." Paul could sense her deep fury, barely controlled by her strict Bene Gesserit training. "We will need more axolotl tanks. I'll send out a call for volunteers." The Gola of Thufir Hawat entered and stared in disbelief at what had happened, his face an ashen mask. After the ordeal on the planet of the Handlers, he and Miles Tegg had bonded closely. Thufir now helped the Bashar with security and defenses aboard the ship. The 14-year-old struggled to sound authoritative. "We will find out who did this." "Scan the security images," Shiana said. "The killer can't hide." Thufir looked embarrassed, as well as angry and so very young. "I already checked. The security imagers were deactivated intentionally, but there must be other evidence. All of us were attacked, not just these axolotl tanks." Duncan's anger was plain as he turned toward young Thufir. "The Bashar has cited several previous incidents that he believes may be sabotage."
"Those were never proved," Thufir said.
"They could have been mechanical breakdowns, systems fatigue, natural failures." Paul's voice was ice as he took a last lingering look at the infant that would have been Gurney Halleck. "This was no natural failure." Then Paul's legs went suddenly rubbery. Dizziness rose around him and his consciousness blurred. As Chaney rushed to grab him, he reeled, lost his footing, and hit his head hard on the deck. For a moment, blackness enveloped him, a gloom that brightened into a frightening vision. Paul Atreides had seen it before, but he didn't know if it was memory or prescience. He saw himself lying on the floor in a spacious, unknown place. A knife wound deep inside him sucked out his life. A mortal wound. His life's blood poured onto the floor, and his vision turned to dark static. Gazing up, he saw his own young face looking back at him, laughing. "I have killed you." Chaney was shaking him, shouting into his ear. "Usul, Usul, look at me." He felt the touch of her hand on his own, and when his vision cleared, he saw another concerned face. For a moment, he thought it was Gurney Halleck, complete with an inkvine scar on his jawline, the glass splinter eyes, the wispy blonde hair. The image shifted, and he realized it was the black-haired Duncan Idaho, another old friend and guardian.
"Will you protect me from danger, Duncan?"
Paul's voice hitched.
"As you vowed to do when I was a child? Gurney is no longer able."
"Yes, Master Paul. Always." The honored Matres clearly devised their own name for themselves, for no one else would ever apply the term honor after seeing their cowardly, self-serving actions. Most people have a very different way of referring to those women. Mother Commander Mirbella, assessment of past and present strengths. Weapons and battleships were as important as air and food during these supposed end times. Mirbella knew she would have to change the way she approached the problem, but she had never expected such resistance from her own sisterhood.
With both anger and disdain, Korea cried, "You offer them obliterators, Mother Commander? We can't just hand over such destructive weapons to Ix." She had no patience for this. "Who else will build them for us? Holding secrets among ourselves only benefits the enemy. You know as well as I do that only the Ixians can decipher the technology and manufacture great quantities for the coming war. Therefore, Ix must have full access. There is no other answer." Many worlds were building their own gigantic fleets, armoring every ship they could find, working on new weapon designs, but nothing had so far proved even remotely effective against the enemy. The technology of the thinking machines was unsurpassed. But with a supply of new obliterators, Mirbella could turn the machine's own destructive power against them. After snatching the weapons from fringe machine outposts centuries ago, the honored Matres could have formed an impenetrable line and hurled obliterators at the oncoming enemy. If they had stood together for the common good, they could have prevented this whole problem. Instead, those honored Matres had fled. Thinking about the hidden history she had excavated from deep within other memory, Mirbella continued to be annoyed at those ancestors. They had taken the weapons, used them without understanding them, and depleted most of their stockpiles in their petty revenge against the hated Tleilaxu. Yes, many generations earlier, the Tleilaxu had tormented their females, and the honored Matres had good reason to direct vengeful violence against them. But such a waste! Because the honored Matres had been so profligate in using the planet-roasting weapons against any world that offended them, only a few obliterators remained intact. Recently, when cracking down on the rebel-honored Matres strongholds, Mirbella had expected to unearth greater stockpiles. But they had found nothing. Had someone else stolen the weapons? The guild, perhaps, under their original pretext of helping the honored Matres? Or had the whores truly used them all, holding nothing in reserve? Now the human race had insufficient weapons left to stand against the real enemy. The obliterators were as incomprehensible as any device Tio Holtzman had ever created for folding space, and the women had never known how to create more. For the sake of humanity, she hoped the Ixians could do so. Times of extremists demand extreme actions. Under her orders, the members of the United Sisterhood now removed the powerful weapons from their no-ships, battlecruisers, and infiltration vessels. She would take them to Ix herself. Mirbella cut off continued arguments as she marched with a small entourage toward the Chapter House spaceport. "But Mother Commander, at least negotiate patent protections," Lyera said, a flush showing even on her dark skin. "Impose restrictions so that the technology does not become widespread." She was one of the most businesslike Reverend Mothers, filling much of Belanda's old role. "Proliferation amongst planetary warlords could result in the devastation of the largest star systems. Chome alone, working with Ix, could wreak—" Mirbella cut her off with a disgusted noise. "I have no interest in who may or may not benefit commercially after we win this war. If the Ixians help us achieve victory, they are entitled to profit." She rubbed her chin thoughtfully as she looked up at the ramp of her small, fast lighter. "We'll let the planetary warlords deal with their own problems." You play with feelings as a child plays with toys. I know why your sisterhood does not value emotions. You cannot value what you do not understand. Duncan, Idaho. Letter submitted to Reverend Mother Belanda.
Shiana used an authoritative tone, just short of voice.
Respect for the truth comes close to being the basis for all morality. And I want the truth from you. Now.
Garimi raised her eyebrows and said calmly, A quote from Duke Leto Atreides to bolster the interrogation? Shall we bring in blazing lights and a truth-sayer?
My truth-sense is sufficient. I have always known you well enough to read you.
The shock waves from the appalling crime in the birthing center rippled through the no-ship. The slaughter of unborn Golas, the destruction of 3 axolotl tanks, tanks created from volunteer sisters, went beyond anything Shiana had expected from even her most vehement detractors. Her suspicions had naturally turned toward the outspoken leader of the ultra-conservative faction. Inside an interior conference chamber whose doors were sealed, Shiana stood like a stern schoolteacher, facing 9 of the most prominent dissenters. These women had opposed the Gola Project since its inception, disagreeing even more vehemently after Shiana's decision to restart the work. Under the blistering scrutiny, Garimi stared back, while her supporters were openly hostile, especially the squat Stuka.
Why would I damage an axolotl tank? It makes no sense.
Within her mind, among the lives in other memory, she heard the now familiar voice of the ancient Serena Butler, sounding horrified.
Killing a child.
Serena was an odd visitor in other memory, a woman whose ancient thoughts should not have traveled down the corridors of the generations, and yet she had been with Shiana for years now.
You have shown a previous willingness to kill Gola children.
Shiana finally sat down. Garimi fought to control her trembling.
I attempted to save us before Leto could become a threat, before he could become the tyrant again. That was all, and I failed.
My reasons were well known, and I stand by them. Why would I go to such extremes now? What do I care about Halleck? Or old General Xavier Harkonnen? Even Serena Butler is so far buried in our past that she's little more than the smoke of a legend. Why would I bother with them when the worst Golas, Paul Muad'Dib, Leto II, the fallen Lady Jessica, and Aaliyah the Abomination, already walk among us?
Garimi made a disgusted rumble in her throat. Your suspicions offend me.
And the evidence offends me. Despite our disagreements, we are all sisters, Garimi insisted. At first, the fleeing Bene Gesserits had had a common cause, a shared goal. But in a matter of months after their escape from Chapter House, the divisions had begun. Power struggles, command questions, a bifurcation of visions. Duncan and Shiana focused on escaping from the outside enemy, while Garimi wanted to found a new keep and train a fresh Bene Gesserit population according to established ways.
How have we changed so dramatically? How did the divisions get so deep?
Shiana gazed from face to face, looking for indications of guilt, particularly in the eyes. Short, curly-haired Stuka had a line of moisture on her upper lip, one of the indicators of nervousness. But she detected no hatred there, no loathing sufficient to have sparked an act of such brutality. With dismay, she had no choice but to conclude that the perpetrator was not here.
Then I need your help.
The person standing next to any of us could be a saboteur. We must interview everyone. Gather our qualified truthsayers and use the last stores of the truth trance drug. Shiana rubbed her temples, already dreading the huge task.
Please leave me alone, so I can meditate.
After the 9 dissenters departed, Shiana stood alone, her eyes half closed. The population aboard the Ithaca had grown, spread out in the no-ship over the years. Even she wasn't sure how many children were aboard, but she could easily find out. Or so she presumed. She murmured to other memory,
"So, Serena Butler,
was your murderer in the room? If not them, then who could it be?" Serena's voice interjected, full of sadness. "A liar can hide behind barricades, but all barricades eventually fall. You will have other opportunities to discover the murderer. There is sure to be more sabotage." The truthsayers tested each other first. 28 qualified Reverend Mothers were gathered from Garimi's followers and from the general population of sisters. The women did not protest their innocence or complain about the suspicions cast upon them. Instead, they accepted mutual questioning. Shiana observed coolly as the women formed triads, two individuals acting as interrogators, the third as the subject. As soon as each subject passed the rigorous questioning, the roles switched, so that everyone was questioned. One by one, the truthsayers created an ever-growing pool of reliable investigators. Everyone passed the test. Once the truthsayers had confirmed each other, Shiana allowed them to question her. Garimi and her dissident sisters also faced the challenges and proved their innocence, as did Shiana's staunch followers. All of them. Next, with a truthsayer named Kalissa beside her, Shiana stood before a stiff-backed Duncan Idaho. The very thought of Duncan being a murderer and a saboteur struck her as absurd. Shiana wouldn't have believed it of anyone on board, and yet 3 axolotl tanks and 3 Gola children had been butchered. But Duncan, standing so close to him, smelling his perspiration, feeling him somehow fill the room with his presence, summoned dangerous memories in her. She had used her own sexual bonding skills to break him free of Mirbella. Despite their backgrounds, both knew there had been more to that passionate encounter than just a necessary task. Duncan had been uneasy around her ever since, afraid of what he might succumb to. But in this situation, there was neither romance nor sexual tension, only accusations.
"Duncan Idaho, do you know how to bypass the security imagers in the medical center?"
He looked past her, not blinking. "That is within my capabilities."
"Did you commit this terrible act and cover your tracks?"
Now his gaze met hers. "No."
"Did you have any reason to prevent Gurney Halleck, Serena Butler, or Xavier Harkonnen from being born?"
"I did not." Now that Duncan faced her and a truthsayer, Shiana could have asked him questions about their personal relationship to witness his reaction. He would not be able to lie to her or pretend. But she feared his answers. She didn't dare ask.
"He speaks the truth," said Kalissa.
"He's not our saboteur." Duncan remained in the room when Bashar Miles Tegg came for questioning. Kalissa displayed images of the horrific scene from the birthing chamber.
"Are you in any way responsible for this, Miles Tegg?"
The Bashar stared at the images, looked up at her, turned his gaze to Duncan.
"Yes."
Shiana was so startled that she struggled to think of another question. "How so?" Duncan asked.
"I am responsible for security aboard this no-ship.
Clearly, I failed in my duty. If I had done a better job, this atrocity never would have occurred." He glanced at the troubled Kalissa. "Since you asked me in the presence of a truthsayer,
I couldn't lie. Very well, Miles. But that isn't what we meant. Did you commit this sabotage or authorize it? Do you know anything about it?
No,
he answered emphatically. Dozens of private chambers were set up where the interrogations could continue unabated. They asked every one of the Gola children, from Paul Atreides all the way to 9-year-old Leto II, and the truth-sayers detected no criminal falsehoods. Then the rabbi and all of the Jews, and every other passenger aboard the no-ship. Nothing. Not a single person seemed to be connected with the murderous incident. Duncan and Teg used their Mentat skills to check and recheck the lists of people aboard, yet they could find no errors. No one had evaded questioning. Sitting across from Shiana in the otherwise empty interrogation room, Duncan steepled his fingers. There are two possibilities. Either the saboteur is capable of deceiving a truthsayer, or someone we don't know about is hiding aboard the Ithaca. In well-organized teams, the Bene Gesserit blocked off, then sectioned the no-ship's decks, methodically moving from cabin to cabin and chamber to chamber. But it was a formidable task. The Ithaca was the size of a small city, more than a kilometer long and hundreds of decks high, each filled with passages, chambers, and hidden doors. While trying to guess how someone else might have sneaked aboard, unknown to them, Duncan remembered discovering the mummified remains of Bene Gesserit captives the honored Matres had tortured to death. That sealed chamber of horrors had gone undetected during the whole time Duncan had been held prisoner inside the ship on the Chapter House landing field. Could someone else, an unknown honored Matre perhaps, have remained hidden aboard for all that time? More than 30 years. It did not seem possible, but the vessel had thousands of work bays, living quarters, corridors, and storage lockers. Another possibility. During the escape from the planet of the Handlers, several face dancers had crashed small fighters into the no-ship's hull. Mangled bodies had been pulled from the wreckage of those ships. But could it all have been a ruse? What if some had actually survived those kamikaze crashes and slipped away? Perhaps one or more face dancers were lurking in the untraveled passages of the no-ship, looking for ways to strike. If so, it was imperative to find them. Teg had already installed hundreds more surveillance imagers at strategic locations, but that was only a stopgap measure at best. The Ithaca was so large that even the best security equipment had thousands of blind spots, and there simply weren't enough personnel to monitor the imagers already in place. It was an impossible task. Still, they tried. As Duncan accompanied a group of 5 searchers, he was reminded of a beating party marching through the tall grass on a big game hunt. He wondered if they would scare a deadly lion out from somewhere in the vastness of the vessel. Deck after deck was searched, but even with a dozen teams, a complete inspection from the topmost deck to the lowest cargo hold would take a great deal of time, and in the limited searches they conducted, they found nothing. Duncan was exhausted and stressed, and the murderer, or murderers, remained aboard. Only 2 options are before us now. Defend ourselves or surrender to the enemy. But if any of you believes that surrender is a viable option, then we have already lost. Bashar Miles Teg, speech given before the Pelicor engagement. Leaving the obliterators on Ix for the fabricators to study and duplicate, Mirbella traveled next to the main guild shipyards on Junction.
Administrator Rentel Goris, with long, pale hair and milky eyes, led Mirbella among the construction bays, suspensor cranes, conveyors, and assemblers, all of them teeming with workers. The buildings were tall and blocky, the streets serviceable rather than beautiful. Everything on Junction was done on a breathtaking scale. Great lifters hauled components up to the skeletons of gigantic ships, assembling one vessel after another. The air held the bitter tang of hot metal, the chemical residues from welding mismatched components into huge vessels. Goris seemed overly proud. "As you can see, we have the facilities you request, Mother Commander, provided the price is right." "The price will be right." With the new sisterhood's wealth in melange and soustones, Mirbella could meet virtually any demand for payment. "We'll pay you well for every ship you create, every vessel that can be placed into battle, every craft that can stand against the thinking machine army. The end of our civilization is at hand if we don't defeat the thinking machines." Goris did not seem intimidated. "Every side in every war believes their conflict is crucial to history. But most often those are delusionary and needlessly alarmist thoughts. This war may be over before you have to resort to such measures." She scowled. "I don't know what you mean." "There are other ways to solve the problem. We know that outside forces are sweeping into many planetary systems. But what do they want? To what will they concede? We believe such discussions are worth pursuing." He blinked his milky eyes. "What sort of trick is the Guild trying to play on us this time?" "No trick, just sensibility. Regardless of politics, commerce must continue. Wartime desperation inspires technological innovation, but peace promotes profitability in the long run. Trade will go on, no matter who wins the conflict." Highliners had long been the luxury ships of the universe. Now Mirbella forced the Spacing Guild to devote their shipyards to creating the tools of war. For centuries, the Guild's commercial fleet had been stable, and demand for trade steadily increased as people returned from the scattering. Now, however, with Omnius's fleet wiping out whole populations and sending refugees in panicked flight back into the heart of the old empire, Chome and the Guild were in turmoil. A hot wind from the assembly bays blew in Mirbella's face, burning her nostrils with the acrid smoke of waste chemicals. A shiver coursed down her spine. "Our common enemy must be rational," Goris continued. "We have therefore dispatched emissaries and negotiators out to the war zone. We will find the thinking machines and make our proposal. The Guild would prefer to continue its commerce regardless of the outcome of this disagreement." Mirbella gasped. "Are you insane? Omnius seeks the extermination of all humanity. That includes you." "You overstate your case, Mother Commander. Some of our emissaries will, I believe, achieve our goal." In the background, blasts of steam curled up from the stone smokestacks. She ignored the noise and the smell. "You are a consummate fool, Administrator Goris. Thinking machines do not follow the rules you assume." "Be that as it may, we feel obligated to try." "And what is the result so far?" "Acceptable losses. Our first emissaries have disappeared, but we will continue the effort. We plan for all eventualities, even disaster." Casually, he led her out onto a broad, open field under the half-assembled hulk of a huge ship. "Thus, we are comfortable with extending certain beneficial terms to the new sisterhood. You have always been a valued customer, But the order you submitted is massive. Even under wartime conditions, you have asked for more ships than we are able to provide.
Then offer your workers more incentive.
Ah, Mother Commander, but will you provide enough incentive to us? She bristled.
How can you think solely of profits when the fate of the human race is at stake?
Profits determine all our fates. The administrator gestured casually, as if to encompass the huge assembly of the ships around him.
We'll pay what you demand, and the Guild Bank will offer us loans if necessary. We need those ships, Goris.
He smiled coolly. Your credit is good, but we must address another problem. We do not have enough Guild navigators to man so many new ships. All of the vessels we build for you will have to be equipped with Ixion mathematical compilers rather than traditional navigators. Is that acceptable?
Provided the ships function as we require, I have no objection. We don't have time to develop and train another population of navigators.
Obviously pleased, Goris rubbed his hands together. Of late, navigators have proven somewhat intractable due to the shortage of spice. A shortage which your sisterhood created, Mother Commander. It is because of you that we had to look for alternatives to navigators.
I have no fondness for navigators or for your obscene profits.
I don't care how the Guild accomplishes it, but we need those ships.
Of course, Mother Commander, and we shall provide what you wish.
That is precisely the answer I need. What is the advantage of prescience if it serves only to reveal our own downfall? Navigator Edric. Message to the Oracle of Time. The Guild bureaucrats had the audacity to call Edric's Highliner back to the shipyards on Junction. Staring ahead with his milky eyes, Administrator Goris blithely announced that the Highliner would be fitted with one of the new Ixion mathematical compilers.
Our spice supply line is undependable. We must be certain each vessel can operate safely if its navigator fails. Over the past 2 years, more and more Guild ships had been outfitted with the hated artificial controls.
Mathematical compilers.
No simple engine or tool could adequately complete the phenomenally complex projections that a navigator performed. Edric and his fellows had evolved through immersion in spice, their prescient vision strengthened through the power of melange. There could be no mechanical substitute. Nevertheless, Edric had no choice but to accept a team of qualified and arrogant Ixion workers who shuttled up from the Junction shipyards. The tight-lipped men boarded the Highliner under the watchful eyes of the Guild, with their smug expressions, compiler machines, and dangerous curiosity. In his tank, Edric was concerned that they would snoop around under the pretext of completing their installation. The Navigator faction could not risk these men finding Waff's laboratory, the genetically altered sand trout, and the small mutated worms he was producing in his tanks. The Tleilaxu man claimed to be making excellent progress, and his work must remain a secret. Therefore, when the Ixion installers were all safely aboard, Edric simply folded space, informing no one in the shipyards where he was going. He carried his empty Highliner far out into an isolated wasteland between solar systems, and there ejected the disbelieving Ixions, along with their accursed navigation machines, out into the cold vacuum.
Problem solved.
His acts would be discovered eventually, but that could not be avoided. Edric
was a navigator. Mere human administrators had no hold over him. Edric suspected that the devious administrator and his faction saw the Melange crisis as an opportunity to shift the guild's burden away from problematic navigators. They did not really want a new source of spice. Goris was now an absolute ally, if not a puppet, of the Ixians. Edric had seen the economic projections and knew that the administrators considered navigation machines to be more cost-effective than navigators, and more easily controlled. With the Ixians and their machines happily ejected, Edric knew it was time to call another meeting with his fellow navigators. They needed to receive fresh guidance from the Oracle of Time. Because Junction and several other guild planets were already compromised by Goris and his cronies, Edric chose a place that no one but navigators could find. Once they had been shown how, they could fold their guild ships deep into another dimension, a non-traditional universe where the Oracle occasionally went on personal, incomprehensible explorations. Ignited by the light of 7 newborn stars, the cosmic gases swirling around his giant ship seemed inflamed. The nebula shone pink and green and blue, depending on which window of the spectrum Edric chose to look through. The misty curtains put on a spectacular show, a great whirlpool of ionized gases, and a perfect place to hide. When the ships gathered, the navigators were in quite an uproar, and their numbers were less than Edric had hoped. So far, 400 Highliners had been decommissioned, their parts salvaged to construct new no-ships that relied on artificial guidance systems. 17 navigators had died horribly, their tanks emptied. Edric learned that 6 of his fellows had likewise murdered the Ixian engineers rather than allow them to install mathematical compilers. 4 navigators had simply disconnected the machines, and the onboard Ixian teams failed to realize that their vaunted systems were no longer functional. "We require Melange," he transmitted. "By the grace of spice, we see through folded space." "But the Sisterhood has denied it to us," one of the other navigators said. "They have spice. They spend spice, but they do not give it to us. The witches give it to the guild for ships, but the administrators have cut us off. We are betrayed by our own. They control the spice." "But they do not control us," Edric insisted. "If we find our own source of spice, we will not need the administrators. This is for the survival of navigators, not simply for commerce. We have struggled with this problem for years. The Tlilaxu Gola has finally come up with a solution." "A new source of spice? Has it been proven? Is anything fully proven? If this goes well, we can destroy the corrupt old spacing guild and supersede them." "We must speak to the Oracle." Edric waved his tiny, misshapen hands. "The Oracle already knows our problem." "The Oracle has not deigned to help us," said another. "The Oracle has her own reasons." Drifting in his tank, Edric acknowledged their conundrum. "I have spoken to her myself, but perhaps all of us together can urge her to respond. Let us summon the Oracle." Using their spice-enhanced minds, the numerous navigators shot a message arrow through the folds of space. Edric knew they had no way to coerce the Oracle of Time, or the Oracle Infinity, as she was sometimes called, to respond, but he sensed her presence, and her deep uneasiness. With a silent flash, a trap door opened in the vacuum, and the ancient container arrived. It was not quite a ship, for the Oracle could travel anywhere she wished, mentally folding space without the help of Holtzman engines. Even in that small and non-threatening enclosure, Edric knew full well the power and immensity of that highly advanced mind. As a human, Norma Senva had first discovered the connection between spice and prescience. She had developed the technology of folding space, had created the incomprehensible equations that T.O. Holtzman had taken as his own. Though the Oracle used no known transmitting device, her words were loud and implacable in their minds.
"Your concerns are parochial. I must find the wayward no-ship. I must determine where Duncan Idaho has taken it before the enemy intercepts it."
The Oracle often chose her own esoteric goals without explaining them. One of the navigators asked, "Why is the no-ship so important, Oracle?"
"Because the enemy wishes to have it.
Our great foe is Omnius. Except that he is as changed from his former computer Evermind as I am evolved from the human I once was. The machines have completed their high-order projections. The Evermind knows he must have the Kwisatz Haderach, just as I know the enemy must not have him."
The Oracle let the silence hang in space like a hole before she added a stinging rebuke.
"Your appetite for spice is not the priority. I must find the ship."
Abruptly discontinuing the debate, she winked out again and vanished into her own place in an alternate universe.
Edric and the gathered navigators were shocked by her response. Navigators were dying. Spice was dwindling away to nothing. Administrators were trying to overthrow the guild. And the Oracle simply wanted to find a lost ship?
22 years after escape from Chapter House.
"These new face dancers cannot be detected by DNA analysis or any other form of cellular scrutiny. As far as we know, only a Tlilaxu master can tell the difference."
Bene Gesserit, Report on Human Mutation. Though the Ixion specialists had studied the obliterators for half a year, they still hadn't given the Sisterhood an answer. Mirbella brooded in her offices on Chapter House, waiting. The news seemed to worsen with each passing day. She received regular updates on the depredations of the thinking machine fleet. The powerful enemy ships moved inexorably through the fringe systems like a crashing tidal wave, drowning world after world. Another 10 planets evacuated or contaminated by plagues, another 10 lost, and more refugees flooded into the old empire. A network of sisters met with any refugee ships that came from the battleground systems. Taking statements from groups of survivors, they compiled an exhaustive three-dimensional map of the movements of the machine fleet. The pattern seeped like a bloodstain through the galaxy. In a single desperate stand, 19 Sisterhood no-ships expended their last 3 obliterators to destroy a whole battle group of oncoming machine ships and temporarily prevent the annihilation of one human-inhabited system. In the end, though, even that devastation amounted to only a brief delay. The machine fleet came back with greater strength and crushed the world after all, killing every inhabitant. With the last obliterators gone, the new Sisterhood was woefully underdefended. Unless the Ixions could help. What was taking them so long? Finally, a lone Ixian engineer came to Chapter House to deliver his news. When he said he would speak to no one but the Mother Commander herself, escorts brought him to the main keep. Waiting on her imposing throne in front of the dust-streaked, segmented window, Mirbella could respect the man for bypassing bureaucracy and getting to the core of the matter. The engineer's face was bland and unmemorable, his brown hair closely cropped, his demeanor unassuming. He had a peculiar, unpleasant odor about him, perhaps from chemical residue or the machinery of Ix's underground fabrication plants. He bowed perfunctorily and stepped in front of her. Our best engineers and scientists have deconstructed and analyzed the sample obliterators you provided. Mirbella leaned forward, giving him her full attention. And you can reproduce them? Better than that, Mother Commander. His confident smile held no warmth at all, was simply an imitation of a facial expression. Our fabricators understand the underlying concept of the weapon and are able to concentrate its destructive power. Previously, it required several honored Matre battleships deploying multiple obliterators to kill a planet. With our enhanced weapon, a single ship can launch enough firepower to do what was done to Rakkis. He gave a perfunctory shrug. Imagine what such an energy release would do to enemy battleships. Mirbella tried to conceal her delight. We need as many as you can produce. Instruct your factories to begin work on these weapons immediately. She kept her voice hard, letting her impatience seep through. But why did you need to see me in person when you could easily have sent a message with this information? Her lips quirked. Do you require a pat on the back? Shall I give you my applause? There, you have it. The Ixian engineer remained bland. Before we begin, Mother Commander, there is the matter of payment. Chief Fabricator Sen has instructed me to inform you that Ix must be compensated if we are to pull our profitable manufacturing centers offline in order to create these obliterators for your war. My war? All humans must share the burden of the cost. Unfortunately, we disagree. The only payment we will accept is spice, and the only source of spice is your new sisterhood. We have other ways to pay you. Mirbella tried to conceal her alarm. She wasn't sure their fledgling spice operations could supply the necessary amount. And why would Ix care about spice in particular? Sisterhood accounts in guild banks could be drained. Chome could be convinced to supply important commodities. And Sue stones were more valuable than ever, especially since the recent turmoil on Boozle. When she offered these alternatives, though, the Ixian fabricator shook his head. I have no flexibility in these negotiations, Mother Commander. It must be melange. No other coin will do. She ground her teeth, but had no patience for further delay. Spice it is, then. Get started. Departing from Chapter House, Crone the Face Dancer felt content. The new sisterhood had bowed to his demands, as he had known they would. Back on Ix, he had the ear of the chief fabricator, and Face Dancer replacements already controlled all key Ixian manufacturing centers. Crone found it ironic to demand payment in spice, since Ix had devoted so much technological effort into installing navigation machines in guild ships. Thanks to the mathematical compilers, Melange was basically obsolete when it came to folding space, and the navigators were fading swiftly. but by insisting on such a huge payment in spice alone, and then hoarding the commodity, Krone would remove a large amount of it from the market, making it even rarer. That, in turn, would force more and more ships to convert to the Ixion navigation compilers, because the guild could not support the melange needs of their navigators. Before long, with no way of supporting their own navigators, the whole spacing guild would fall under Krone's control. He had worked it all out in exquisite detail. In the meantime, he and his disguised workers would make it look as if they were providing everything the Sisterhood demanded. Let them fight useless battles while the real war was already won, right under their noses. Mother Commander Mirbella would be quite satisfied, up until the moment a curtain of darkness fell on humankind. Permanently. Every man makes errors. When a security chief makes them, though, there are consequences. People die. Thufir Hawat, the original. The Bashar and his protege marched down the corridors toward the no-ships life support center. I am deeply ashamed, Thufir. It has been almost a year, and I am incapable of finding a blatant saboteur and murderer. The young Hawat looked up at him, clearly idolizing the military genius. We have a limited pool of suspects, and a discreet area in which he, or she, could hide. We've done everything possible, Bashar. And yet the saboteur is here, somewhere. Teg did not slow his pace. Therefore, we have not done everything possible, because we still haven't found the person responsible. The fact that there have been no further murders does not mean we can let down our guard. I am convinced our saboteur is still among us. The Ithaca was constantly being searched and monitored. Additional surveillance imagers had been installed, but the culprit seemed to have an affinity for hiding. Teg suspected that the work of the saboteur went well beyond the murder of the Golas and the axolotl tanks. In recent months, many ships' systems had inexplicably failed, too many to be caused by random events and natural breakdowns. Our adversary is still at work. The Thufir Gola raised his smooth chin in a display of pride. He was strong and gangly with a heavy brow. He had let his hair grow shaggy. Then you and I will find him. Teg smiled at Thufir. As soon as you regain his memories and experience as a warrior mentat and master of assassins, you will be a formidable ally. I'm formidable now. Thufir had already proved his worth during the tense escape from the handlers, risking his own life to help the rabbi get away from face dancers in league with the enemy. Teg believed the young Gola had the potential to do much more. Varying his pattern, he insisted on an exhausting round of daily security inspections while he left Duncan, Idaho on the navigation bridge, ever vigilant for the enemy's glowing net. The Ithaca continued to wander in empty space. At first, their voyage had simply been to get away from the enemy hunters. Duncan had been forced to remain hidden behind the ship's veiling no-field, since the old man and woman seemed to want him in particular. Now, after more than 2 decades, the population aboard had increased, and children were growing up and being taught necessary skills without ever having set foot on a planetary surface. Despite all the worlds settled during the scattering, habitable systems seemed sparse indeed. For the first time, Teg wondered how many ships of refugees fleeing from the famine times had simply died without ever finding their destination. The Ithaca had no guild navigator. Only pure chance brought them within range of planets. So far, they had encountered only 2 places that might have supported a new colony. One honored Matre world that had been completely wiped out by enemy plagues, and the planet of the insidious handlers. Nevertheless, with its recyclers, greenhouses, and algae tanks, the aging Ithaca should have been able to sustain the present number of passengers for centuries if necessary. They, and their successors, could effectively stay on board forever and never stop running. Is that our fate? Teg asked himself. But because of leakages, losses, and accidents, the passengers had cause for concern. Sooner or later, they would need to replenish their reserves. Thinking of resources, the Bashar took a side corridor to the fermentation bins and adjacent algae growth tanks. Grown in the vaulted, humid chamber, the biomass provided raw material for the food manufacturing units. A prime vulnerability. As he opened a hatch, Teg caught the rich, marshy smell of compost and algae. They climbed metal steps to a catwalk and looked down into the cylindrical vat filled with hairy green slime. The stinking wet mass of fecund algae digested anything organic, growing large amounts of edible, rather unpalatable material that could be converted into better flavored foods. Ceiling fans whirred, drawing the odorous air upward through filters and into the intricate set of ducts that acted as the no-ship's circulatory system. After taking samples and testing the chemical balance of the tanks, Teg concluded that everything was in order. No sign of sabotage since his last inspection. The serious young man tagged along beside him. I am not a Mentat yet, sir, but I have been giving the sabotage problem a great deal of thought. With raised eyebrows, Teg turned to his protege. And do you have a first order approximation? I have an idea. Thufir did not try to conceal his anger. I suggest you have a long talk with the Yui Gola. Perhaps he knows more than he has admitted. Yui is only 13. He does not have his memories back. Maybe the weakness is in his blood. Bashar, we know that someone committed the sabotage. The young man sounded disappointed in himself for allowing it to happen. Even the real Thufir Hawat didn't find the traitor in House Atreides before he betrayed us to the Harkonnens. That traitor was Yui. I'll keep it in mind. Back in the corridors again, the two passed a sick-looking old Sightail and his clone emerging from their quarters. Because they isolated themselves and lived with odd traditions and behavior, the Tleilaxu were natural suspects, but Teg had found no evidence against them. In fact, he believed the real saboteur would be careful to blend in perfectly and draw no attention at all. It was the only way he could have remained hidden for so long. Two pregnant women passed by them in the corridor, chatting as they continued on their way. Both were part of Shiana's conventional breeding program to maintain the population of the sisterhood, providing an adequate genetic base should the splinter group ever find a place to settle. Finally, Teg and Thufir reached the cavernous, humming engine chamber and entered the large aft compartment through a round doorway. Apparently safe, but lost again since their last passage through fold space, the Ithaca drifted, though Duncan insisted on keeping the Holtzman engines ready at all times. Thick, clear plaz separated the Bashar and Thufir from a trio of power plants that fed the machines. Walkways laced the outside of an explosion-proof plaz chamber that contained the side-by-side engines. The two stared up at the giant mechanisms that could fold space. A true miracle of technology. All of the readings remained within nominal range. Again, no sign of sabotage. We're still missing something, he mused. I can feel it. Once before, at the end of the Battle of Junction, Teg had failed to see the terrible and deadly weapon that the honored Matres had held in reserve. That mistake had nearly lost him the entire war. He considered their situation now. What deadly device will I fail to see this time?
Humanity has a great genetic compass that constantly